bin your plastic Jesus. That was our strapline when a couple of years ago we spent a whole year going through most of Luke's Gospel. The sermons are all on the website if you want to catch up on that there. But we didn't quite finish Luke, so we've come back to do that over these next few weeks. And what an appropriate place for us to be in the weeks leading into and flowing out of Easter. If you like statistics, here's one. There are 89 chapters, I make it, in the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, added together, 89 chapters. 29 of them concern the events of a one-week period as Jesus enters Jerusalem to die and comes out raised from the dead the other end. A third of all the Gospel material covers the events of just 1 week in history. And so our aim is that we, our friends who will invite, I hope you will invite friends to celebrate Easter with us, people who will give flyers to out on the street who we don't even know yet, the prayer is that all of us will not simply revisit the familiar events of Easter. Luke's big aim is that we will all go away with a deep sense of confidence and certainty about what the events of Easter really mean, and a deep sense of assurance that if you are trusting in Jesus, and then this individual here at the foot of the cross, full of hope and liberation, is you. It's Thursday evening. You know you're going to die tomorrow. What do you do the night before you die? We're in our first point if you're following along on the handout. I should say there are some big Old Testament ideas in this passage tonight, so don't worry if some of them feel new. Do keep talking about them afterwards. Some of them we will get the chance to revisit in 1 Corinthians, which is a great thing. The mood music of Luke 22 is very mixed, and this is something we'll get used to these next weeks throughout these chapters, as we see the high moment in God's glorious rescue plan overlapping with the low point of, well, grubby humanity, basically, in our plot to kill the Son of God. Our reading is topped and tailed with the plotting. I've put some extra notes inside the handout. They're not particularly to look at now, but they might be helpful as you think about making sense of the role Judas has here and what that says more generally about how human responsibility and God's sovereignty fit together. Feel free to pick that one up afterwards if you'd like to do some thinking around that. But the focus really in this reading is not Judas's plotting and planning. It's Jesus's planning and arranging for the Passover celebration. See, events are not running out of Jesus' control at this point in Luke's Gospel in any way. Now, verse 7 to 13, that paragraph shows us that Jesus is completely on it with the details. So verse 10, he said to them, "Behold, when you have entered the city, a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him into the house that he enters, and tell the master of the house, 'The teacher says to you, where is the guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples?'" Now, I don't think there's any suggestion. That's a slightly sort of weird, mysterious paragraph, isn't it? You know, the man with the water jar. It sounds slightly spy movie. I don't think there's any suggestion that Jesus is using his supernatural powers in this paragraph, or that he's telling the disciples to use Jedi mind tricks on the bloke who owns the guest room. You know, you don't need to see our identification, that kind of thing. No, he's just the one who's been organized enough to book a room for the office party. Jesus is in charge here, and he is completely clear on what is about to happen. That seems to be why he's so determined to get this Passover meal on, so that he can provide the commentary about his death. You know, sometimes you might have come across this. It's suggested that the gospel writers, and Luke in particular on this, didn't really have very much of an idea of what Jesus' death meant. They just wrote down the story. It's suggested that pushy people like the Apostle Paul came along later and added this spin that Jesus' death was somehow a death for the sins of other people. Sometimes that kind of argument comes from a place of, well, not liking actually the traditional understanding of what Jesus' death means. Sometimes it comes from an agenda of wanting to use the cross as an inspiration for a particular religious or political agenda. Don't get me wrong, the cross of Jesus is very deep and very profound. It has many layers and facets that we can learn from it. But the passion narrative, as this part of Luke's gospel is sometimes known, is not just a narrative of the events that happened. The events are interpreted for us. And our interpreter, in the first instance, is not Paul or even Luke. The interpreter of the death of Jesus is Jesus. He's our teacher in this part of Luke's gospel. He calls him the teacher in verse 11. And he's in teacher mode as he explains what his cross means. We'll get more explanation over the next few weeks. We'll travel the journey with Jesus from the upper room to a garden and then finally to a hill where he will complete his mission. And Jesus, in these chapters, will be the one who teaches us very clearly that his death is in our place for our sins and by his blood. Now, maybe that seems a weird thing to you for me to go on about. Maybe you've never even questioned before. Of course, that is what Jesus' death is about. But those ideas are under attack. And so you'll need to be really clear that Jesus' death is in your place for your sins and by his blood, both for your own assurance of forgiveness through your life and so that you won't be too unsettled when you come across some of these alternative explanations. The big thing really today is that Jesus' death is like the Passover, fulfills the Passover. And you can see that's the point from, I don't know, maybe as your leader ever talked about the repetition tool in your Bible study, you can see that quite clearly here. So verse 1, it's called the Passover. Verse 7, the Passover lamb. Verse 8, prepare the Passover. Verse 11, verse 13, and there it is again in verse 15, this Passover. I don't know if you've seen the film Prince of Egypt, the full version that clip came from, but every time you see that word on this page, Passover, that is the scene that you're supposed to have swirling round in your head. And I don't know if you've seen the film, maybe the song Deliver Us playing in the background as well. Passover equals deliverance. 'Tis the season to be rescued. Much more specifically, Luke makes a direct link between the Passover lamb and Jesus. Verse 7. Then came the day of the unleavened bread, on which the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed. Had to be. That's a phrase that's come up several times in Luke's gospel about Jesus' mission. So he had to suffer many things, chapter 9 said. He had to go to Jerusalem, chapter 13. Chapter 17 again, the Son of Man had to suffer many things. Just like the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed, Jesus had to suffer in that way as well. Verse 15 makes the link between Jesus and the Passover lamb even tighter. Verse 15, and he said to them, I've earnestly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. seems to be drawing the Passover and his suffering together. And that tying together continues in verse 16 to 18, where he seems to draw the Passover and his kingdom work together as well. Maybe you didn't know that in Exodus, when God gave them the instructions for the Passover, the lamb that they were going to slaughter for the family had to actually move in with the family for a few days. Maybe that was a little bit awkward and seems a bit cruel to the kids, doesn't it? Just as we're getting to know Sean the sheep, the moment arrives. But if you were the eldest son in the house, you would not be sentimental about Fluffy. On the evening of God's judgment, the lamb was slaughtered. The blood was put on the door so that when the angel of the Lord came into the land, the angel would pass over that house. We spent a year in Exodus in our midweek studies a couple of years ago. Maybe you remember it. We reenacted this scene. Anya, our women's worker, borrowed, I think, from McDonald's about 50 sachets of tomato ketchup. I think she bought a milkshake as well, so that I'll have a milkshake and 50 sachets of tomato ketchup with it, so that it wasn't stealing. But we had a great time. Definitely wasn't stealing. We had a great time basically reenacting this. We had doorposts on each table. We read the instructions, and we made a great mess with the tomato sauce. Why did the angel pass over when it saw the blood? Well, because a death has already taken place there. No need for judgment in that house. The lamb died so that you didn't have to. Verse 19 is the clincher on this connection between Jesus and the Passover. So there was a ritual for how this ceremony was supposed to progress: an opening prayer, a cup of wine passed round, some psalms read, another cup of wine. And then they would eat the main course: the roast lamb, bitter herbs, the unleavened bread. The host would give thanks, as Jesus does here. But the rest of verse 19 is a revolution. And he took bread, and when he'd given thanks, he broke it and gave it to them, saying, "This is my body, which is given for you." It's so familiar to us, isn't it? I wonder if we can feel any of the weight of what Jesus is doing here. He announces his death, ties it to the Passover, and then at the key moment in the meal, he says, "This is actually no longer about the Passover lamb. It's about my body, represented by the broken bread and given for you." Given for you means instead of you, taking the hit for you, given, broken, to rescue you. Now, that's quite a big idea to get our head around, isn't it? The idea that Jesus takes and fulfills all that Passover meaning. And I don't know if you can fit in your head another quite big Old Testament idea that Jesus grabs hold of here and makes his own. It's in verse 20. "And likewise, the cup after they had eaten, saying, 'This cup that is poured out for you is the new covenant in my blood.'" A covenant is like a contract, like a marriage contract, where you bind yourself to another party. That was why God rescued them at the Passover, to bind them into a relationship with himself. The marriage ceremony, if you want to call it that, happened a bit later in Exodus chapter 24. And it was formalized as Moses made sacrifices. And do you know what he did? This is what they did to kind of seal the covenant. He basically threw a bucket of the blood of the sacrifices over all the people. Now, we always reenact the Passover. I've never seen anyone reenact that part of the Exodus story, and I don't know how you feel about that as a way of sealing a covenant. I guess it's a bit like the exchange of rings in a marriage. So I wonder if you asked me to officiate at your wedding, how would you feel if at that point I said, I now pronounce you husband and wife, and produced a bucket of blood onto the bride and groom? I guess that might be the last marriage that Kev ever did for anyone at Euston Church. But you should thank me if I did that, because it's a covenant sealed in that act of the blood. Now, that marriage was doomed, God and Israel, mainly because of Israel's unfaithfulness, prone to wander, that line from the song we just sang. But God had promised a new covenant, a very different kind of covenant. Jeremiah 31 is the reference if you want to read about it. It's one that human beings could never mess up by their sin. And the reason this is so big, as Jesus says, covenant, is because covenants are really rare in the Old Testament. God doesn't get married every day. But as Jesus dies in our place, it has this relational purpose for us as well. As he pours out his blood on the cross, a new covenant, a new contract between God and his people gets established. And I think this is all quite hard for us to get, because for us, most of us, the centre of gravity of the Bible is the Jesus stuff, isn't it? It's the New Testament. We always think of all the other stuff as prequel, if you like. But for these guys, this was thousands of years of their heritage and the things that identified them as a people. Passover, covenant, grabbed by Jesus and claimed as his own. Now, I mentioned that not everybody likes the idea of, well, a substitute punishment and blood being at the heart of the sacrifice. Some people find that quite offensive. And one commentator I read said that actually he thinks that Luke could not possibly have said or written verse 20. And his reason for thinking that Luke can't have written verse 20 is that it appears to concentrate the whole of God's redemption in the cross. And this guy has got some quite interesting logic, this commentator. He's basically saying, I don't like the idea of blood being at the heart of this. Therefore, Luke could not have possibly said that. Therefore, verse 20 cannot be part of Luke's original text. That's quite an interesting way of interpreting the Bible, isn't it? And not one we would be able to approve of if we have a high view of the scriptures. And I think it's actually a real shame that that commentator goes that way with his logic, because I thought that in the first half of his sentence, he summed up the situation brilliantly. God concentrates the whole of his redemption in the cross. And our purpose, as we move on to our second point, is to be people who remember. This is another thing that links Jesus' death with the Passover, just as it was integral to the Passover that it was remembered. Jesus makes remembrance central for his rescue as well. Verse 19, second half. This is my body, which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. Now, one thing I always find interesting when you look back into the detail of the Exodus story, there's actually more information about God saying, this is how you should remember the Passover in the years to come after I bring you out of Egypt. More instructions about remembering than actual airtime to the event itself. Such a big deal that they remember. And if you know anything about the rest of the story of Exodus, you'll know that that was just God knowing what they were like. They were very quick to forget, which is why he tried to stress the point about remembering. So can I ask you, how is your memory? You'll need one to be an active, lively Christian in the long term. My memory is fading generally, I have to say. Some of you students who are quite friendly to me as an older person try to include me in your conversations. You know, what did you do for your 21st birthday, Kev? Or what did you do for your graduation? And I genuinely have to say I cannot remember what I did. I said that this morning. Someone thought I meant because there were so many substances involved in my 21st that I can't remember. Just to clarify, it's just that it's so long ago. I'm sure whatever I did, it was a very dull affair, I'm afraid. But if we can nail remembering, then actually we've hit on one of the key spiritual disciplines of the Christian life. I'm going to say something particular about the Lord's Supper, and then something general about remembering as we finish. So the Lord's Supper. Just as Jesus' death was like the Passover, the context here suggests that the remembering of his death should in some sense be like the Passover as well. It happens in the Passover context. Not that we're supposed to follow all the ritual of the Passover, but we're meant to follow the pattern of remembering. And what that means is a kind of remembering that doesn't just recall historical events by looking up on Wikipedia or giving the kids a Passover quiz. It's actually interesting, in Jewish culture it seems to be quite a big thing, from what I've looked at on YouTube, loads of videos where they try to reenact in a fun way for the kids the events of the Passover. One of the best ones I saw was into the song of Bohemian Rhapsody with puppets. And Moses in the role of Freddie Mercury saying, "Pharaoh, let my people go, let my people go." And Pharaoh is a big sort of evil-looking fox in that version. But there's also a Playmobil version of the Passover, and the one I like best, a Star Wars version of this reenacted. And I take it the reason that Jewish people do that is because they take seriously the fact of the verses that I read out near the start. This is a thing to be passed on and remembered by the children. Listen to this. This is from Deuteronomy chapter 6, and it's quite interesting who Moses is speaking to here, because this is, if you like, Israel, the next generation. The Exodus lot had mainly died in the desert. Listen to what Moses says in Deuteronomy 6 verse 20. "When your son asks you in time to come, what is the meaning of the testimonies and the statutes and the rules that the Lord our God has commanded you? Then you shall say to your son, 'We were Pharaoh's slaves in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand.'" And Deuteronomy 16, verse 3. "You shall eat no leavened bread with it. For 7 days you shall eat it with the unleavened bread, the bread of affliction. For you came out of the land of Egypt in haste." Now notice the words there. We were brought out of Egypt. You came out in haste. And actually, Moses is talking to people here who mainly weren't born at the time. But for them, remembering the Passover meant treating it as their event, almost as if they were actually personally there. Now, obviously, Passover was a one-off. It wasn't like they had to mentally pretend it was only happening now. But the remembering was in the sense of, God did this for me. It's my story of how he saved us. On Passover evening, Jesus is not suggesting that the bread is him or anything like that. He's not suggesting this is a new sacrifice that has to be repeated. Very clearly, it's a once and for all. But as we reflect on the cross, to follow the pattern of remembering from the Passover, it seems that it shouldn't be just the bringing to mind of a historical event for us. And that as I take the bread and drink the wine in the Lord's Supper, we are remembering our story. In that sense, reliving our story as the Israelites relive the Passover. And so maybe in that sense it's a bit more like at Remembrance Day, which we have in the UK. Maybe it's a bit more like seeing yourself as one of the World War II veterans in the 2-minute silence, rather than just a school kid who's heard in a book that World War II actually happened. And it's great, this, because, you know, we're often saying we're not allowed to just read ourselves into every passage of the Bible and assume that it's all about us. And it's something that people say in life generally, isn't it? You know, it's not all about you. Do you ever have to get told that by your family and friends? Well, Jesus says, look at what he says in verse 19. My body, which is given for you. Verse 20, the cup that is poured out for you. And 1 Corinthians, quoting that, makes it clear that that isn't just the 12, that for you is about all of his disciples. This is about you. So that as a Christian, when you celebrate the Lord's Supper and reflect on the cross, it's kind of like you've got to remember yourself back into the events that took place. A real body that was spat on, nailed, blood flowed, so that you might come into a covenant with the Lord of all. Isn't it amazing? It's not automatically for you, though. And in this remembering, I guess we're physically, tangibly taking into ourselves something that we receive by faith when our hearts believe and trust in the death of Jesus. I like the way the liturgy that we use puts it. Take, eat in remembrance, and feed on him in your heart by faith with thanksgiving. It's great to hear Ed's story earlier, wasn't it? What's your story as a Christian? My story is that I was a slave, but he rescued me. There should have been judgment, but he passed over me. There was blood, and he made a covenant with me to bind himself to me forever. That is your story if you're a Christian here today. And Jesus doesn't particularly set details here about how often this event has to be celebrated. Some people think that the Passover connection means it should be an annual celebration, the Lord's Supper. I don't think that's ever prescribed. We're under a different covenant from them. 1 Corinthians, we're going to look at the passage there in a couple of weeks' time, seems to suggest it was something they were celebrating more regularly, but then they were quite a dysfunctional bunch, so we shouldn't necessarily take Corinth as our lead and our example in these things. And I put on the sheet some verses that are the key passages you need to engage with as you work out what you think about the Lord's Supper. And that is a really important thing to do, to just get into the texts, because there are loads of ideas and loads of paraphernalia that has grown up around communion. You want to make sure you're as biblical on that as you can be. I'm afraid some stuff in the Church of England that we are part of looks like it's putting more emphasis on the ceremony than the thing that we're remembering. And sometimes in the liturgy hints at the fact that we in the Lord's Supper are making an offering to God. I'm afraid in official Roman Catholic teaching, both those points are institutionalized. It is about the ceremony, and it is about us making some kind of sacrifice to God. That is not the Lord's Supper, as Jesus sets it out. It's about remembering something that he has done. But it's easy to point the finger at other people, isn't it? I've been reflecting on this and just thinking, we probably don't at Euston Church celebrate the Lord's Supper as often as we should. There are some technical Church of England reasons for that. I won't bore you with them now. But do we take this seriously as something really important that Jesus has given us? And when we celebrate the Lord's Supper, well, do we feel the weight of it as a serious event, not just something that we tack on at the end of a meeting? More generally, on remembering, as we finish, I wonder how big is remembering the death of Jesus in our community life together? I think there's a lot to give thanks for. I think we have some great songs that celebrate the cross, don't they, that I think really help us to get excited about what Jesus did there. We've got our logo, haven't we? You know, we conveniently picked a name that had the letter T in the middle for Euston Church that meant we could turn it into a cross. And I hope that isn't just marketing, I hope that really means something about what we think as a church family. And personally, can I ask you, is the cross still at the heart of how you connect with God? This can be very easy, can't it, to become something that we connect with God based on activity, or based on the stuff that we are doing for Him, even if that's not a thing that we would verbalise in that kind of way as the thing that saves us. What is your comfort when you sin, or when life is disappointing, or when you worry whether God actually loves you? That question at the bottom of the sheet, I'd love us to talk about that later in our conversations. How central is the cross to your story, our story, as the people of God? It could just be very easy to forget it, can't it? Or, like Israel, just to get distracted in other things. There's a few distractions in the Church of England. You know, there's festivals and saints' days and things for all kinds of things. Mother's Day. I'm not having a go at Mother's Day. You know, you'd be a brave person, wouldn't you, to kind of rise up against all the mothers in the world and suggest that it should be banned. That's not what I'm saying. But the celebration of His death is the big one that Jesus specifically asks us to remember. I've just been wondering, are we remembering the cross as much as we can in our presentation of the Christian message to other people? The temptation is always to focus on something that sounds more impressive. We've heard that in 1 Corinthians, haven't we? Jews demand a sign. Greeks seek wisdom. Will we keep preaching Christ crucified? Is that a bit too boring and foolish? Will we prefer to say something that sounds clever or fresh or something about new experiences and signs? Just thinking about the way we maybe sometimes too much focus on, in our presentation, the life and the teaching of Jesus. You know, we say, look at the life of Jesus, look at His teaching, you'll think it's great. Now, that is a good thing to talk about, obviously. But if we never actually get to the cross, then we've not really told people the heart of the gospel. Just think how Easter just feels a bit awkward, doesn't it, compared to Christmas, which is also jolly. I'm thinking, I've never heard of a school that does an Easter version of the Nativity sort of thing. Have you? You know, sorry you didn't get to play Joseph, but anyone want to be Judas in the Easter version? You know, anyone want to be the centurion that actually hammers in the nails? Now, Easter is embarrassing in that sense. It looks weak. Will we keep preaching Christ crucified? May we always preach Christ crucified at Euston Church until the day when we meet Jesus and we say, worthy to the Lamb who was slain. That's the thing that will define Him forever, and it will define our relationship to Him forever. And it's a good reason, isn't it, to think about inviting friends. I hope you will invite friends to Easter. We're trying to do that, and maybe just to bravely say to people, look, it's great you come at Christmas, but this really is the heart of what we believe and the thing that we want you to hear about. A story as we finish. Mary needed a blood transfusion. The doctor explained to her brother Johnny that the only chance for Mary's survival would be from a transfusion of his blood. Would you give your blood to save Mary? The doctor asked. Little Johnny's lip trembled. He paused and thought about it. But then he smiled and said, of course. They were taken into a hospital room together, Mary pale and thin, Johnny healthy and strong. They started taking Johnny's blood. But soon he started to tremble. And he asked the doctor, Doctor, when do I die? Poor little boy, he'd misunderstood what they were saying to him. He thought all of his blood was going to be extracted to save his sister, bless him. And yet, he still did it. Well, we needed a solution far more serious than a simple medical procedure. Now, when the Son of God was required to pour out His blood for us, it really did require all of it. And yet he still did it. Deliberately, willingly. The greatest rescue moment in the history of the world. Why did he do it? Why did he do it? Luke 22, verse 19 tells us two words: for you. That's the reason he did it. For you.